It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check out the presidential race and what candidates have to say about funding for higher education.
First, the country could have a new set of policies to alleviate poverty under new proposals announced by U.S. Speaker Paul Ryan with other leaders from the House.
The new plan is part of a new initiative called A Better Way, Our Vision for a Confident America. It begins with an examination of poverty. According to Speaker Ryan, it rests on five principles.
Number one, reward work. Number two, tailor benefits to people's specific needs. Number three, demand results. Hold each other accountable. Number four, improve skills and schools. Number five, help people save and plan for their future so that people have their own horizon that they're shooting for. This is how you fight poverty. This is how you create opportunity.
This isn't the first effort in Washington to deal with the problem of poverty. How does this plan differ from previous attempts, and how feasible is it all?
Joining us now to talk about that new plan and how it could work is Ron Haskins. He's the co-director of the Center on Children and Families and Senior Economic Studies Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Ron, you've been following plans like this. How much of this plan is new?
If you put it all together, to have all these proposals in one place is new, but not very many of the proposals are completely new. And I would say two of the most interesting things about it are that the set of proposals contains a lot about evidence-based policy, which is very important in Washington, might put your audience to sleep. But most of our programs don't work, and Ryan has definitely been in the lead and in a bipartisan way with Senator Murray from Washington, establishing a national commission and introducing lots of legislation to improve the quality of programs. So that's a very important part of the proposal. And then secondly, it is surprisingly bipartisan. I think there are a number of things, there are many things in the proposal that I think could lead to, real negotiations between the Republicans and the Democrats. In the last paragraph, they say that they're starting a conversation. That's kind of interesting for Washington, and I think that's right. There's plenty here that Democrats and Republicans can talk about and maybe work out a proposal for next year.
We're going to listen to another clip from today. This is Representative Mike Conaway of Texas speaking with Paul Ryan.
None of us want people trapped. None of us want people stuck, mired in their circumstances. But the key is that person needs to want to get unstuck. That person needs to want to get out of that mired circumstances. And our programs sometimes trap them there, even the ones who want out.
So now this has been a familiar framing difference between conservatives and liberals on this. In this, you hear maybe more of that strand of personal responsibility, as conservatives would frame it, and as I've seen it framed already in some liberal sites, they say it's more of the blaming the poor aspect of this. How do you see that strand in it?
I think the last decade or so, and even the last 20 years since the 1996 Welfare Reform Bill, which was all about work and making people accept responsibility for work, and I think that there's been a real change among liberals, progressives, Democrats, in recognizing that personal responsibility is an important part of this agenda, and part of what needs to happen is that parents need to be more responsible, and kids need to be more responsible, too. Government needs to do a lot, don't get me wrong. Progressives are not going to give up on that, and neither are Republicans. But I think there's been a movement together between Republicans and Democrats over the last 10 or 20 years in this regard. There's still space between them, but I think we're closer to agreement on this. And you can cut a deal between Republicans and Democrats that emphasizes both personal responsibility and how the government can help.
So you think there's real opportunity for bipartisanship in this plan? Not everyone sees it that way. So where do you see these real areas where you think cooperation could be possible?
Well, there's definitely cooperation on evidence and the role of evidence, and there's a lot we can do to make sure our programs are, I shouldn't say make sure they're working, but to find out if they're working, and if not, either improve them or replace them. So that's certainly bipartisan. A number of his proposals on post-secondary education, especially reforming the programs and giving parents and kids better information And there's a lot we could do to make it simpler to apply for federal aid, especially Pell Grants, and a lot of good ideas for loans, paying back loans as well. I think there's plenty of room for bipartisan compromise there. And earlier this year, and starting, in fact, starting last year, AEI, which is a kind of right-of-center think tank, and Brookings Celestive Center think tank, organized a group of Republicans and Democrats scholars from around the country, and they reached agreement on a bunch of things I think that would be very difficult to agree on, like minimum wage. And Democrats, in exchange, were willing to emphasize things like marriage, which I think has to be an important part of the agenda. So I think there is a movement, both outside and inside Washington, to try to reach bipartisan compromise. Certainly the country's sick of grandstanding and all kinds of partisan taunts in Washington, and I think members on both sides of the aisle realize that, and they might be willing to work together. Of course, a lot will hinge on the presidential race. Unfortunately, I think no matter what happens, the presidential race is going to create even more partisanship. But I think the members themselves are moving in the right direction.
We're talking with Ron Haskins right now, co-director of the Center on Children and Families, also senior fellow of economic studies at the Brookings Institution. And you mentioned some reform to Pell Grants. And also, I know this plan calls for some reforms to Social Security as well, which has always been, you know, it's known as the third rail of politics, but here it is in Paul Ryan's plan. And these are both areas that have the potential to worry a lot of people. What do you know about those plans to reform Social Security and Pell Grants so far?
Well, I think the third rail of American politics does not exist for Paul Ryan. Everyone says that about Medicare, too, and he's proposed extremely interesting reforms in Medicare. Unfortunately, didn't pass. But at some point, we are going to have to pass reforms that are similar to, or at least achieve the ends of his proposals on Medicare. So I don't think he's scared off by some feeling that you shouldn't make any proposals to reform Social Security or Medicare. And his proposal is to increase, again, personal responsibility. It's not an area I follow very closely, but Ryan definitely has been talking about, and all Republicans have been talking about, not relying too much on Social Security and taking some of the pressure off Social Security by having individual accounts, which Republicans have a lot of ways to try to make them easier to get and make them more attractive to individuals. So far, none of that has taken. There's no way the Democratic Party is going to turn their back on Social Security, so that area will be very difficult to work things out.
And we know other parts of the plan call for requirements for job training and child development, and these, of course, are things that require funding. Do we know how much House Republicans are calling for to support efforts like these?
In the proposal, they do not talk about funding. They don't mention any figure. They don't say that they're going to increase funding. I think in order to get, I just wrote about this today, and I think in order to get bipartisan legislation, they will have to have more spending, and under congressional rules, which Ryan does everything he can to follow, he's probably the most committed of the Speaker or Majority Leader in the Senate in recent years to making sure that we follow the rules on budget. And I think that that we will have to finance any spending with either increased taxes or cutting other programs. Republicans are not going to have increased taxes, so that means we're going to have to match new spending with program cuts. And I think it's possible to work that out. I'm not predicting it'll happen, but that's going to be an area of a lot of attention. Democrats are going to want to spend more money, especially in the context of what the Democratic presidential candidates have proposed, tens of billions of dollars in new spending, which I think is pretty unrealistic. Even if Democrats control both the House and the Senate and the presidency after the election, which seems highly unlikely, but even if they did, they would have a difficult time spending anything near the amount of money that either Clinton or Sanders envisions.
And finally, Ron, as we wrap up, another one that could be, has the potential to be controversial. Part of the plan calls for the reining in of the power of the Secretary of Education and expanding choice schools. Looking at the Secretary of Education, what would replace the leadership in that role?
I don't know exactly what they're going to propose. Republicans always talk about that. It's a talking point, and a lot of it's rhetorical. The legislation that was passed last year to reform the No Child Left Behind bill on a highly bipartisan basis, has already limited the reach of the federal government at least somewhat in education. So I think at least part of that agenda has been achieved. I would not expect that there would be big changes in education for the remainder of this year or even next year, because Congress has a habit of not returning to major legislation for at least several years. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of changes, and it's very difficult for Congress to limit the authority of a secretary in an administration that's run by the other party. So I would not look for any serious changes there.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Ron Haskins is the co-director of the Center on Children and Family and senior fellow of economic studies at the Brookings Institution. And he joined us to talk about a new plan being proposed by U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan today.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk about a study that found that there's no monetary reason for having all white casts in Hollywood movies because films with diverse casts perform better at the box office.
First, higher education funding and student loan debt have been big issues in Wisconsin's politics and budget situation, and they've emerged as part of the presidential campaign as well, with the remaining candidates laying out some of their policy ideas in recent weeks.
This is the first major financial issue for many Americans, with well over $1 trillion in current student loan debt and a new cohort of students and families figuring out how to cover the cost of college education every year.
Doug Letterman joins us now. He's editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into specifics, Doug, have candidates been paying, do you think, enough attention to these issues, higher education funding and student loan debt?
Well, the history shows this is not higher education, though it appears on the list, topping the list and near the top of a lot of individual voters' lists. It has not played a hugely significant role in most presidential elections. This year's promises could be a little different. Certainly on the Democratic side, we have seen both major Democratic candidates talk pretty significantly about it. Donald Trump, as I think as is true on a lot of issues, hasn't been particularly focused on a lot of policy proposals. So, but I do think that it's likely to be a way in which some of the Democrats probably seek to differentiate themselves and particularly to attract young voters. That's where I think we've seen the issue tend to be used, is to try to attract young voters. And both candidates on the Democratic side, Sanders has had more success reaching student voters and young voters. Hillary's going to definitely need those to do well in the fall.
If ever student loan debt and higher education were going to be factors in an election, I mean, we're up, as we mentioned, over $1 trillion apparently in student loan debt. It sounds like this could be the year that it's an issue that would resonate with a lot of potential voters, especially younger voters, but maybe people who've been carrying that debt for 10,
sure.
20 years.
No question. And I think that's thinking about the election in terms of the larger sort of political trends, we have certainly seen over the last, in this administration, has really intensified the focus on higher education and student debt. And I think in general, the trends of the last, let's say, decade have been for the federal government, as the federal government has really ramped up its investment financially and otherwise in higher education, we have seen the politicians ask a lot more and expect a lot more of higher education, and I think that's a trend that is irreversible. We are going to see it may be reversible that the money flows as much as it has during the Obama administration, but I think the trend of the government and politicians asking more of colleges, demanding evidence, proof of performance and proof of outcomes, that ship has sailed, and I think that's where it's going for the foreseeable future.
You mentioned we've heard from the two remaining Democratic candidates on this, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. What have they had in common? Where do they share agreement on their policies they've expressed so far?
Well, not surprisingly, I think I heard the end of your last slot, and you know, in general, the Democrats tend to propose and prefer solutions that involve more government, more spending, and that's certainly the case on higher education as well. Both Democrats have proposed plans that, in one way or another, would what they have in common, in one way or another, they would sort of try to make higher education more affordable by linking federal funds to how states behave when it comes to higher education. That's probably the way in which the plans are most similar. Both of them would try to leverage, use federal funds and the promise of funds to support students and colleges to require states to spend money themselves, either at comparable levels or to spend more. And that would represent a pretty big change in sort of the traditional relationship between the federal government and the states. Now, the plans would do this in very different ways, but that's one area in which they, and both of them use the word free in one way or another, but and again, in very different ways. Bernie Sanders' plan would basically really push states to offer free tuition to many, if not all, students. Hillary Clinton's plan would require states to create debt-free options. You know, it would require every state to ensure that citizens had a public higher education option that would not require them to go into debt. But there's a lot of differences within that broad framework.
Now, the word free in either case is striking in higher education as in a store, I guess. But the plans you're outlining sound like they'd require a cooperation with states to some extent. I mean, to some extent, using federal money as a lever to get states to do certain things. But states would have to play along. And is there any expectation that all 50 states would do so?
Not hardly. And you're, you know, in fact, you know, Wisconsin is certainly one of the states where it's pretty hard for people, given the way things have unfolded there in recent years. It's kind of and the stance of the current governor. It's kind of hard to picture he and Governor Walker and some of his like-minded governors in other states being willing to bow to the sort of demands of the federal government. I mean, I think all you have to do is think about some of the politics around the Affordable Care Act, and you could see some of the same dynamics playing out. Hillary Clinton has sort of attacked the Sanders plan on that grounds that it's unrealistic to expect governors, and she did this while she was in your fair state, specifically unlikely to expect Governor Walker, she said, to play ball like this. She didn't quite mention, as our story pointed out a few weeks ago, that her plan would also be helped and may require some cooperation with the states. Although she had a vision, their plans, both of which are a little undetailed at this point, had a way for individual institutions to opt in if their states didn't. But those details are a little hard to fully grasp at this point.
We're talking to Doug Letterman. He's editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. He's with us to look at the presidential candidates, the remaining ones in the major parties, and what they've had to say or suggest about higher education costs and student loan debt. And Doug, you said we haven't necessarily heard as much from Donald Trump on this. I've seen at least some hints that he would want to reform things, more market-driven approach to college funding, higher education funding, and he said something about the colleges, universities sharing the risks of student loans somehow. What do we know, if anything, about that?
Well, so again, the candidate himself has been focused elsewhere in general. He's had a few stray comments here and there about certain education issues, but he's had very little to say, and we've been promised a sort of education and higher education policy framework, but haven't seen that yet. But we published about a month ago, not quite a month ago, an interview with Sam Clovis, who's been his national co-chair and policy director, and who's a professor at a small college in Iowa, that laid out some of the ideas that he said they were kicking around. We didn't get much confirmation from anybody else within the campaign, and we haven't seen reinforcements of that. But one of the ideas that he mentioned, and it's an idea that has gained a good bit of support and across the aisle, interestingly, in D.C. and elsewhere, is this idea of what is called risk sharing, which is basically requiring institutions, individual colleges and universities, to holding them accountable by forcing them to more or less vouch financially for when they give loans and giving, again, what a common phrase that's used is making sure they have skin in the game, such that if one of their students defaults on a loan, they pay something of a financial price. And there are a bunch of different ways where that could be done. Right now, there isn't such there is very little incentive. It's that we've had a system over the past where the government provided the loan, either if originally lenders and now the government provide the loans, they're guaranteed by the government. The government provides a guarantee to them. But in this broad realm of proposals, individual institutions would basically have to pay some amount if a student defaulted on a loan. And that would, in theory at least, force them to pay much more attention to whom they admit and how successfully they are led through the and helped through the through to graduation and then to a job. Because we know that for all the attention paid to these the graduate of NYU who's with $120,000 in debt working as a Starbucks barista, that's really the outliers. The people who really struggle with student loan debt are those who don't get a credential of any kind and don't have something of value that they can use. And even with the debt levels can be comparatively small, but they can still be debilitating.
We'll leave it there for now. Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
We've been talking to Doug Lederman. He's editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed, and he joined us to look at higher education funding and student loan debt issues and how they're playing out, what we're hearing from the candidates in the presidential race.
Coming up after the news, Hollywood has long been criticized for a diversity problem. We'll talk about a new study that found that Hollywood movies actually do better at the box office when they have non-white actors in leading roles. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our next guest tells us how you can best support people observing Ramadan in your community.
First, we're taking a look at Hollywood, which has been criticized in recent years for casting decisions. A lot of movies have gotten a thumbs down from critics for the lack of diversity on the screen.
Studio executives have blamed the audience, saying moviegoers prefer movies with mainly white casts. But a recent study found that there's no business incentive for having all white casts in mainstream Hollywood movies because films with more black actors actually performed better at the box office.
Joining us now is Venkat Kapuswamy. He co-authored that study, and he's an assistant professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at Kenan Flagler Business School at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Venkat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, I want to ask first, why did you and your colleague try to put some numbers on this, try to measure box office results with the ethnic makeup of a movie's cast?
Well, it was actually serendipity. My co-author, Pete Yunkin at McGill, and I, we've actually performed a lot of research on biases in economic marketplaces, and we were focused on racial biases in the context of crowdfunding, like using Kickstarter or Indiegogo to raise money. Then we heard all this talk about the lack of diversity in movies when the Oscar nominations came out. And given my love of movies and the fact that my PhD work was on box office data in Hollywood, I thought, hey, you know what? Why don't we actually look at whether diversity has economic consequences in Hollywood and provide some data and statistics to either prove or disprove some of the popular claims out there. And so it was really... just listening to the anger following the Oscar nominations this past year, and we quickly came up and performed a study within a couple of months.
Well, let's talk about that study. How did you set it up?
Well, what we did is we said, okay, you know what? Let's go back five years specifically, and we looked at all movies that were released domestically in the United States, or more specifically, that were qualified for Academy Award consideration. This is a ton of movies. Basically, one of the major ingredients in that is that you had to have been shown in LA County for at least 7 days. So it's about a thousand movies over a 5 year span. And what we did is we individually looked at the top six cast members for each movie, and we used Amazon Mechanical Turk and our own sweat and tears to code the individual race associated with each actor. So there's a lot of hand coding required, and after we were able to determine the cast composition of every movie, we then extracted financial information using information on IMDb.com, Box Office Mojo, the numbers, and we basically ran an economic analysis controlling for a number of other factors that could also affect box office performance, including the budget of the film, the genre, the star power, et cetera, et cetera. And then all things equal, when we looked at the racial composition of the cast, we found that actually, you know, honestly, converse to our expectations, that diversity actually had a positive effect on box office performance.
Now, the argument that is surprising when compared to studio executives say, sometimes when challenged on diversity issues, well, our audience in the United States, our domestic audience, doesn't want that diversity. They want these bankable, usually white stars in movies. Those are the movies that make more money. It sounds like what you're saying is that's not how it pans out when you run the numbers.
That's categorically false. The numbers just don't justify that statement. The reality is movies with at least two black actors in the principal cast do far better than movies with one or zero.
And another question you looked at along the same vein is, well, maybe these movies do well at the box office, but maybe they don't perform as well when it comes to awards nominations. What did you find there?
Yeah, and that's actually the first outcome we examined, because if you remember, everyone was concerned that, hey, you know what, there were no black actors with Oscar nods this past year, and was this a blip, or was this evidence of bias? So when we actually looked at that, we realized two things. First off, the odds of getting an Oscar nomination are very, very small. And so there was actually no bias one way or the other regarding Oscar nominations. And so you couldn't make the claim that movies that had diverse casts were performing poorer in a critical sense as well.
We are talking about diversity in movies. Venkat Kapuswamy is with us from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He and a colleague did a study looking at the impact of having a more diverse cast. Does it help or hurt the box office bottom line? Short answer, more diversity looks like it helps. Let's look at one of those movies, give a listen to one of those movies with a diverse cast. This is Annie, the 2014 edition, cast black actors in leads, Jamie Foxx as Will Stacks, or Daddy Warbucks, and Kwavenzani Wallace as Annie. Here's a conversation between the two, talking about Annie's dog, Sandy, needing a bathroom break.
Annie, where are you going?
Thanks for everything. Sorry I messed up last night. Hope you can still be mayor.
What are you talking about? Get back here.
It's okay. I'm good at this part. I've had a lot of practice getting kicked out of places.
Just put your bag down. You're not going anywhere.
Sandy's gotta go.
Stop it. You and Sandy are staying here, and I don't care what happened last night.
No, I mean Sandy's gotta go.
No, I mean, oh, Sandy's gotta go.
A tense moment in Annie, the 2014 remake. Now, this is a movie with a more mixed cast. Black leads, but also Cameron Diaz as a supporting actress. How do movies, Venkat, with a mixed race cast do, as opposed to all white or all black? And we'll get to all or mostly black casts in a minute. Is this a recipe for a good box office?
We believe so. The numbers are quite startling. Over 75% of all movies have zero black actors, so a quarter do. And of that quarter, only 10% have two or more black actors. And so the amount of movies with diverse casts are actually quite small, all things considered, which is quite unfortunate.
It's an interesting point about the numbers there. Is there any reason to wonder about whether the sample is too small for you to draw a conclusion?
No, actually, it's on the larger side. We would have been concerned if we had, let's say, 50 films or so, but our sample has... the original sample has 1,000 movies in it, and then the numbers were run with 723, which is a very robust sample going over the past 5 years. Now, the only reason we didn't go back even further was that it takes a lot of effort to code the race of individual actors. But no, this was a very, very substantial sample.
I want to put this in the context of the research you mentioned earlier, looking at racial bias and corporate policy. Is what you're seeing here from Hollywood something you would see in any other industry that maybe it sounds like shooting itself in the foot by not considering its diverse customer base?
I mean, that's what we're trying to really show with this study, that it is... You're leaving money on the table in many cases when you exhibit these biases, either consciously or unconsciously. It is unfair for us to say these biases are conscious, but even if they are unconscious, a wake-up call is in order because ultimately, at the end of the day, these studios want to make money, and these businesses, even in other settings, want to make money. And there's just a clear case where there is demand that is going untapped.
It's interesting because if we're talking about the bottom line driving Hollywood and its production's decisions, as you said, it seems to make sense to have more diverse casts. Has this been looked at closely before, the way you did?
Well, in our opinion, there have been a few descriptive elements basically showing that, hey, you know what, there aren't enough diverse movies, but we don't think there's really been any prior work that has actually tied it to the financial performance of the films. And we thought that ultimately that's what studio executives care about. And, you know, if we can find that at least there's no penalty, there's no justification really to have a less diverse cast.
We're talking right now with Venkat Kapuswamy, Assistant Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, talking about a study that he co-authored, finding that Hollywood movies with diverse casts actually do better at the box office than movies with all-white casts.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see much diversity in the Hollywood movies coming your way? Do you hunger for more of it, more black actors in leading roles or top supporting roles, more women Avengers, say, to name a top movie that's out now? What do you think of what people call whitewashing sometimes, things like Scarlett Johansson playing the lead in The Ghost in the Shell, an Asian character originally? Call 800-642-1234. Our post on the Central Time Facebook page. And what about Oscar night? Are you disappointed that movies that could have won awards with partly or all black casts, more diverse casts, weren't winning this last couple of years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Venkat Kupuswamy. He is Assistant Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And we're talking about the study he co-authored that finds that movies with diverse casts are more popular at the box office than more homogenous casts, despite claims that moviegoers are maybe less receptive to non-white casts.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think about diversity or lack of same in the entertainment industry, especially these Hollywood movies. What score would you give Hollywood films? Are there examples where you think an effort was made and it came out well? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Sean on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I love your guys' show. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
Great topic today. My question was for the author is how is he defining diverse cast? I watch movies all the time, Netflix, in movie theater, HBO, Showtime, and I can't think of one movie off the top of my head that does not have some other races besides white people in it. So I'm curious as how he's defining diverse in his study.
All right. Thank you, Sean. And Venkat.
Thanks, Sean. So very specifically, we are looking at the top six billed cast members of every movie, and we are basically counting the number of African Americans or black cast members within this top six. And we cut that up into three buckets: 0, 1, and 2 or more.
And thanks a lot for that call, Sean. As you mentioned, many fell into that zero category, a lot into one, fairly few into the two or more. And I know people have asked why only black characters. Was that just a matter of logistics?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I myself am of Asian descent, and I would have loved to have had the bandwidth to code Hispanic, Indian, Chinese, et cetera, et cetera. The frank reality is we were limited by manpower. We thought, you know what, black actors represent the largest of the minority categories. So let's first focus there. And then when we have more time in a subsequent study, let's kind of grow it out to include Hispanic cast members and other Asian cast members. But frankly, the reality is, as I was hand coding these casts, the number of Hispanic and Asian, especially Asian cast members, is very, very small. Hispanic are there, but again, quite few and far between, all things considered.
And Sean mentioned you'll often see a non-white character, but you were going again for the top six, so the lead role, main supporting actors,
exactly,
and actresses, not man in store.
Exactly, not man in store. We were really focused on the top six. And you know what? In many films, that's being generous.
Let's read a Facebook comment here from Tom. Tom says, I think a large part of the issue is that people of color often get offered coveted Oscar-worthy roles when it's a depiction of civil rights issues, slavery or inner city struggles, or the sassy foil for one of the main white characters. In other words, when a part is specifically written for a black actor. I'm thinking also about casting ideas that we've been seeing, stories like Hermione being played by an African-American girl, and there being some pushback on that. I mean, what do we know about how people are cast?
Well, I think the assumption is that if race is not mentioned, it's Caucasian, which I don't think is fair. I think you're starting to see instances where you see for example, black actors in roles that don't necessarily specify them. I think one that comes to my mind, and I could be wrong on this, but in the Thor movies, I think Idris Elba played a very prominent role. And I'm not really sure that the character in the comic books was African American.
Was not, I'll say, yeah.
Yeah, so you do see cases of this, I think, in... I mean, there are instances, but few and far between. I think the dominant logic is, when in doubt, it's a white cast profile we're looking for, unless a really good case is made. And one thing I hear a lot about, and I've heard this from others, is that basically two black actors transcend, quote-unquote, transcend race, which is Denzel Washington and Will Smith. But, you know, I think we really need a change of mindset in Hollywood. And I think the claim that there aren't enough diverse stars out there is really rubbish. You need to cast them first before they can become stars. I think there's a pipeline problem there.
Talking to Venkat Kappaswamy from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new research he's co-authored looks at the impact of diverse casting and lead roles in movies, finds that more diversity, more non-whites, they looked specifically at black people, more characters of color equals more money at the box office. Back to our callers now with Larry in Sturgeon Bay. Larry, hi.
Howdy. That is exactly what I was going to speak on. Thanks for having me on, but I was going to speak on exactly the subject of the Asgard thing. You know, when I go to a movie and I know the basic storyline, either with Norse myths, which some of the Avengers come from, you know, and then the idea that somebody's stuffing a black guy in Asgard, you know, that just absolutely insults me, that the fact that you're going to start swapping storylines to meet this whole diversity thing and instead of just telling the story. And the other point I'd like to make is on the coding aspect of it. You know, the fellow says, well, we couldn't code for Mexican, we couldn't code for Native American, we didn't code for Asian. But you, instead of coding for black, you could have coded for all other races, you know, and that certainly would have put a little more plump into the idea. Now, I'm a Native American, so, you know, I'm not talking from the white perspective, hopefully, but I'm just saying, you know, we know it's a closed shop most of the time, but, you know, the study there could have been a little more open, too.
Larry, thanks a lot for the call. So the first point he makes, Venkat, is, hey, don't pander. Don't throw in diverse actors just for the sake of diversity. What do you think?
Well, first off, thanks, Larry. Great question. What I would say is this. Hollywood has to combat the default. The default is that when it's not stated, the race is assumed to be white. So in a way, the ballot is stuffed in the other direction. So there needs to be corrections. And why I do agree to some extent that I think Idris Elba, you know, cast in Asgard might be a little bit of a stretch from a story standpoint. Wait, how many times have we seen a Caucasian actor play an Asian or a Middle Eastern character? Today, I heard about Leonardo DiCaprio being attached to a project where he was going to be playing a Sufi saint, Rumi, who is Afghani by descent. And that seems to be okay, yet we have a problem with Idris Elba playing a Norwegian superhero. And we are talking about superheroes here. So, I mean, there's a little bit of a suspension of reality to begin with.
I want to get at one more movie here. Straight Outta Compton had a biographical film about the hip-hop group N.W.A. had an all-black cast. Let's hear a clip from that.
Like, y'all just got a snapshot of how Americans really feel. We gave the people a voice. We gave the people truth.
Yeah, but your songs, they glamorize the lifestyle of gangs, guns, drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality. What you see when you go outside your door?
I know what I see.
And it ain't glamorous.
You get AKs from Russia and cocaine from Colombia.
And ain't none of us got a passport, so might want to check the source.
Yeah, next question.
Will you be more careful about what you say, how you say it?
No. Probably not, no.
Wow. Freedom of speech includes rap music, right? Well, we exercise in our First Amendment, as far as I'm concerned.
And Venkat, a clip there from Straight Outta Compton. And just briefly, as we start to wrap up here, is that a movie? It did well overseas. It did well at the global box office, $161 million in the United States. Is that an example of how casts that aren't really very diverse can do, or are very diverse, don't have a lot of a mostly non-white cast can do at the box office.
Absolutely. I think that was a major surprise this past year from both a commercial and artistic perspective. And I hope that's the first of many, many to come. And it's not to say that casts have to be entirely black or entirely Hispanic or entirely Asian, but a little bit more diversity in the mix would be great.
Venkat, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Venkat Kapuswamy, Assistant Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at Kenan Flagler Business School at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He joined us to talk about his new study on movies, diversity, and box office sales. Still time to weigh in over at the Central Time Facebook page. It's a special day for us here at Central Time, except we didn't really realize it until our technical director, Michelle Good, played a little bit of sound that she had stumbled across from this date 3 years ago. A quick listen. Hey, it's a new show. Welcome to the first ever pilot broadcast of Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For the next few weeks, we'll be live on the Ideas Network.
Cringing at the sound of our own voices here. We'll fade that now. But that, so that was it. That was the first time we went on this show on the air with this crazy show
that
we came up
with. That was our very first pilot program, the very first time. Michelle pointed out how happy and fresh we sounded.
So young.
So young, so innocent. And innocent in the ways of the
naive.
World. You know what this tells me is that we missed an opportunity to celebrate. And for someone clearly
donuts.
Should have brought in donuts.
Yeah.
But nobody did.
Okay, we failed to celebrate. Well, okay, so our we've been marking our true, and this is like a relationship, but the real anniversary we usually mark is July 1st. We went on the air for realsies
for real.
Every day. That
yeah.
was just once a week, three weeks that month of June, 3 years ago.
Definitely the beginning of something hopefully beautiful. We're still doing it.
Yeah, and you're still listening, I think. So, right, hey, if you want to help us celebrate 3 years of Central Time, I don't know, tweet us at Central Time WPR. Post a note on the Central Time Facebook page, our impromptu, poorly arranged celebration of 3 years of the show on Central Time.